We have just got through the first 11 chapters, and if you go back to kind of the beginning of the book, John is called to write down the things that he sees and hears in chapter 1, and he starts off with letters to the seven churches of Asia, and then we get the throne room scene in chapter 4, and the Lamb opening the seals in chapter 5, and that context goes all the way up through chapter 11. And it gives us a lot of general spiritual truths and general truths about sin and righteousness, good and evil, and good triumphing in the end, those who serve God having victory. And then in chapter 12, we move into kind of a new context, a narrative about the woman, the child, and the dragon. And kind of at this point in the book of Revelation, the summaries of the chapters start to sound like a C.S. Lewis novel. and so we kind of moved out of the seals being opened, the scroll being revealed, because the seventh seal with the seventh trumpet concluded at the end of chapter 11. And then there's a great sign appearing in heaven in chapter 12. So we moved on to a new context here of John's vision. In verse 1, it says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then, being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth." So the three characters, if you will, of this narrative that John sees, the woman, the child, the dragon, each of them represents something. The woman is with child, and she gives birth, and we'll continue reading, and we'll see how all this fits together. But the woman is clothed with the sun, has the moon under her feet, and on her head there's a garland of 12 stars. The thought that most commentators have about this is that the celestial lights, right, the stars, the moon, the sun, they represent the three different dispensations, the stars being the patriarchal age, and then the moon being the law of Moses, and the sun being the fully revealed gospel in Jesus, you know, corresponding with the amount of light, amount of vision that each one gives, right? And that the woman being clothed with all of those things represents or is symbolic of God's people, those who are God's. In verse 1, that would be those who are God's before Christ. I describe it as the remnant, right, spiritual Zion, the spiritual kingdom that God brought the Christ into the world through. So this would be all of those who are his leading up to the bringing of the Messiah into the world, the birth of Jesus. You can go read in Micah chapter 4. If it takes you a minute to find Micah, that's all right. It will me too. Micah chapter 4. We find that we're in a spiritual kingdom context, at least what I like to call it, in verse 7, where he says, "I will make the lame a remnant and the outcast a strong nation, so the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on, even forever." But by the time you get to verse 10, this is the way that Zion is described. "Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in birth pangs. For now you shall go forth from the city, you shall dwell in the field, and to Babylon you shall go, there you shall be delivered, there the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies." So we see spiritual Zion described that way, as a woman with child, bringing forth a child. And I want you to keep in mind that verse 1, the woman would represent God's people before Christ is brought into the world, because we get the history of God's people before and then the Messiah coming and then ascending back into heaven and God's people after. We get that history in a very, very condensed version here. So the woman is with child. She represents those of the remnant that God is using to bring the Messiah into the world. Then in verse 3, another sign appears in heaven. "Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads." fiery red dragon sounds like Satan, right? Well, you would be correct. The fiery red color indicating his murderous nature. The seven heads, remember seven is symbolic of complete. So seven would be his complete intelligence, seven heads, complete intelligence of evil. And then 10 horns, horns are symbolic of power. So he has full power. 10 would be representative of fullness. So full power of evil. And then the seven diadems or crowns would be his full rule over evil. And so this great dragon appears. In verse 4, it says, his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. The most satisfactory explanation I could find for that is that that's just symbolic of his power to overthrow those who belong to God, his power to deceive, his power to bring down. And then what he's doing right here is important for us. The dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. So you've got, right, the remnant is bringing forth the Messiah through spiritual Zion. The Messiah is being brought into the world, and Satan is standing ready at history at that point, ready to try and devour the Messiah. That's the idea here. In verse 5, the woman says she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. So that sentence, to rule all nations with a rod of iron, identifies the child as Jesus for us. If you turn to Psalm chapter 2, the second psalm, in verse 6, beginning, it says, "Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel.'" So Christ, there being the begotten Son of God, right, given the nations to rule with a rod of iron. That's Jesus there in verse 5. Then in verse 6, we have the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So you have the woman who represents the people that belong to God, right, bringing forth the Messiah into the world. Satan is ready to try and stop that process. But the child, notice the last part of verse 5, is caught up to God in his throne. So right here, I don't want you to be thinking of, like, the Virgin Mary and a dragon standing in front of her ready to devour her child and he's caught up in heaven. That's not the context of this. This is the history of the remnant and the lineage of Jesus, Jesus being brought into the world, his death, burial, resurrection, and ascension being taken up to God. And then the woman flees. So, and we'll see further on after he takes kind of a break to talk about the spiritual conflict going on through verse 12, starting in verse 7. We'll see later on that the dragon starts to persecute the woman and persecute the rest of her offspring. So we find then that the woman initially represented in verse 1 the people of God before the Messiah was brought into the world. Then she starts to represent the people of God after the Messiah ascended back into heaven, because the woman's still in the picture.
Isaac, would it be safe to say that she's maybe could be summarized better as just being the remnant? Like, as I could represent the remnant of Israel than the remnant of the church?
I think that's a good way to put it. It's just remembering that remnant applies to church as well as Old Testament remnant.
That could be confusing.
Yep. But yes, that would be a way to describe it, I think, yeah.
There is a verse about the offspring.
Yep, that would be verse 17 of chapter 12.
As a good point, they don't want you to be able to always say,
Yep. Ron, you're reading ahead on me. We'll, we will cover that, and we'll go to Romans 8 to talk about it too, with Christ being the firstborn of many. Right.
Isaac, that imagery there of the of Satan waiting for the child to be born to devour it. I think you really see that already in way back with the prophecy of, or with the messianic prophecy, I guess, of Eve's case. The idea of there being conflict between Satan and Christ, and the seed of the woman, that he would bruise his head and the serpent would bruise his heel. You know, then you also, I think, I've had it explained to me before that looking at the Gospels, you see so many references to demon possession and to all of this seemingly adversaries coming at people around the Christ in his you know, time here on earth. It's like the devil was putting everything he could at him. Even the temptations that are listed there with Jesus going through that, you see Satan just putting everything he has trying to take him.
Yeah. Even using, like, in some cases, using his closest members of his circle on the earth, right, the apostles, to try and get him to stumble. Yeah,
exactly.
He put everything added to it. Yeah, I do. That's a good point, Nathan. That imagery describes that very well. So in verse 7, we get a picture of a war. Remember, in apocalyptic literature, like the book of Revelation, we are given descriptions of things, pictures, right, to form in our mind, and then those symbolize spiritual truths. That's the idea here. So in verse 7, it says, "And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. They did not prevail, nor was there a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Okay. So first thing we notice here is that there's a war, right? Michael and his angels are fighting against the dragon and his angels. Obviously, Satan loses. We know that that's the outcome in any case. But he's named in verse 9, the great dragon, that serpent of old, connecting it back to Genesis chapter 3, and I think that conflict they're initiating with the Christ, yep, and devil and Satan. So he's named just about as blatantly as anything possibly could be in the book of Revelation. We know the dragon is the devil, is Satan. And what he does is described, who deceives the whole world. That's what he'd been doing the entire time. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So if we take this out of the context of the passage that it's in, and we don't read on very far, it's easy to kind of get this idea that this is some kind of like primeval war in heaven before time begins, or maybe that it's like an actual literal battle going on between Michael and the dragon and in heaven. But we have to remember that in the context of what we're talking about here, right, this is a picture, so it's a spiritual conflict, right, between God and Satan, the forces of good, the forces of evil, right, forces of truth, forces of deception. And then in verse 10, we're given the point in time where this event, this spiritual conflict, comes to a climax, right, verse 10 and 11. So verse 10 says, "Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down." So at the culmination of the kingdom of God coming, right, we have that in the text, salvation being made available, the power of Christ becoming full, Satan is being cast down at that time. In verse 11, it says, "And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death." So you've got kingdom of God coming to fruition, salvation being made available, the power of Christ being full, overcoming by the blood of the Lamb. And then you've got persecuted Christians, the word of their testimony, not loving their lives even to the death. So you've got persecuted Christians there in this context of when this battle comes to a climax, when Satan officially loses, right? This is talking about the crucifixion, where Christ has victory, and by the blood of the Lamb, where Christ is sacrificed. That's the timing of this conflict. If you want to turn to John chapter 12, John chapter 12, starting in verse 27, we get Jesus speaking. He says, "Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." The hour of his death is what he's talking about here. Then he says, "But for this purpose I have come. I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven saying, "I have both glorified it and will glorify it again." Therefore the people who stood by and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered and said, "This voice did not come because of me, but for your sake." Notice what he says here. "Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself." So you see kind of a language connection there. Jesus kind of tells us what's happening. This is the point where Satan loses. This is the point where he is cast out. And then in verse 12, we get, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." Okay. If you take the position, right, that this conflict comes to a climax, and Satan is cast out, right, using those words, or cast to the earth, then you have to remember, at the point of the crucifixion, okay, at the point of Jesus' victory, then you have to remember that he had been on the earth before that. In the garden, he's been on the earth tempting people, accusing people, right? So it's not as though he resided full-time in heaven, and then he was defeated in heaven, then cast to the earth. He's been walking around to and fro on the earth for a long time. You can go read in Job. He was walking around to and fro on the earth. That's what he was occupying himself with. So we have to remember that. And also, I want us to at least consider the idea that earth and sea here would be symbolic as well. In chapter 13, as we'll read further on, you've got one beast rising up out of the sea, and then the second beast rises up out of the earth. And commentators in both places, there and here in chapter 12, in verse 12, entertain the idea that earth and sea would be symbolic of the masses of society, that Satan's been cast out to just kind of go after people. He doesn't have any sway. He doesn't have any power over spiritual situations anymore. He's just been cast out to the masses of society. And then there at the end of verse 12, "because he knows that he has a short time," is interesting too. That Satan knows he's already been defeated. He's just waiting for final judgment, just like those people he deceives. So then in verse 13, it says, "Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child." So you've got kind of the history laid out for us here. So if a woman is the remnant, right, God's people, brings the Messiah into the earth through that. And then there's conflict between the dragon and the woman and the child, right? And then there's conflict in heaven. The dragon's defeated, and then the dragon sees that he'd been cast to the earth. There's a continuation of our story. And so he turns to persecute the woman because he knows he can't contend up here anymore. So he goes after the woman instead. And this is where the woman kind of switches in her representation. So there's, she's the remnant bringing the Christ into the world. And now the Christ has been brought into the world and already gone back up into heaven, done his job, and continues to work, obviously. But the woman is still in the picture. It's not as though she was just the mother of Christ. It's also that she, brought forth the Christ and then continues on after that. So she represents now God's people after the Messiah has been on the earth, which would be the church, spiritual Zion continued, if you will. In verse 14, it says, "But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent." Having wings like a great eagle is interesting language, and it's indicative of God's deliverance. If you go look at Exodus chapter 19, Exodus 19, we start in verse 3. "Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, 'Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself.'" He's talking about the deliverance from Egyptian captivity. So he calls it bearing them on eagle's wings and bringing them to himself. And I think that's what we see happening right here in Revelation chapter 12, verse 14. The woman's given two wings of a great eagle, and she flies into the wilderness where she is nourished. It's God's deliverance. Then Isaiah chapter 40. And verse 31 says, "But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." God will deliver those who are his. And that's the picture we get here. The woman is God's people being delivered, being born on eagle's wings. Then in verse 15, it says, "So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood." So the woman's in the process of being delivered, right, in the picture we're getting. And the dragon, the serpent, spews water out of his mouth like a flood after her. The idea behind the water that he spews out, the flood, is that it is symbolic of Satan's lies, Satan's attacks, trials of hardship in general, that he's trying to consume her with those, trying to consume the people of God with attacks like that, deceptions. You can look at Isaiah chapter 43, where this language is used symbolically like that. Isaiah 43 and verse 2 says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you." So the walking through waters, enduring the flood of the river, is used symbolically in that way. And then also in Psalm 32, Psalm 32 and verse 6, which says, "For this cause, everyone who is godly shall pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters, they shall not come near him. You are my hiding place. You shall preserve me from trouble. You shall surround me with songs of deliverance." So we see here God delivering his people from the flood. That's the idea. Then in verse 16, it says, "But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth." This verse is kind of difficult to come up with a satisfactory explanation for. The best one that I could find is that if we take earth and sea being symbolic of the masses of society, right, that the idea is that inadvertently, the earth helps the woman by succumbing to the water. It soaks up all the lies, the deceptions, the attacks, the hardships. So, and the people of God have that to separate themselves from, because it's being soaked up from another area of people. That's the idea that I got. But there's a lot that could be put into that verse, I think. So we just have to be careful as we study it. Then in verse 17, it says, "The dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." So the dragon's failed at the beginning. He failed to devour the child. Then he failed in his battle against the forces of God. Then he failed in consuming the people of God by the flood of his lies, his deceptions, his attacks. And then in verse 17, he's enraged, and he goes off to make war with the rest of the woman's offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's not to say that there are more messiahs. That's not the idea. So the woman here, same woman who bore the Messiah, right? That's why we get the symbolism of the people of God. So the remnant brought the Messiah into the world. Then she starts to represent spiritual kingdom remnant, that is the church. And the rest of her offspring makes sense if you go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse, I'll start in verse 28. It says, "We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. For whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he," that is Jesus, "might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he predestined, these he also called. Whom he called, these he also justified. And whom he justified, these he also glorified." In the sense that we are all children of God, that we are fellow offspring with Jesus. That's the idea here. The dragon's going after Christians, going to persecute, make war with the offspring of the remnant. So do we have any questions through chapter 12 or comments? Yes, the firstborn from the dead. Yeah, he's described that way by Paul in several places. Yeah. If there's nothing else in chapter 12, we'll go ahead and get into chapter 13. It says in verse 1, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads, 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." That's a pretty insane picture that John is seeing here. So first of all, the beast rises up out of the sea. If sea is symbolic, then that would be easy to get to the correct conclusion that this is a kingdom rising up out of the masses of society, especially if, as we'll go to Daniel chapter 7, you'll see beasts representing kingdoms. And this beast has 7 heads, just like the dragon, has 10 horns, just like the dragon, and has crowns like the dragon. But the only difference is the crowns are on the horns instead of on the heads. But it's very similar in the description. And that's fitting because the beast gets its authority from the dragon, as we read in verse 2. And then on his heads of the beast, there is a blasphemous name. So you can see in the description, right, the dragon had full authority over evil, full rule of evil, full power for evil, full intelligence for evil. We see the same things listed off here for the beast. It's given the throne and authority of the dragon. Okay, let's go to Daniel chapter 7. We'll kind of be brief in Daniel chapter 7 as we use it as a reference, but it's a good idea for your own time to study through it all the way and connect it to Revelation. It's very informative. Daniel chapter 7, starting in verse 2. It says, Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Interesting. Four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first beast was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side, had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And then he sees a fourth beast in verse 7. It's dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had, notice this, 10 horns. The beast that John sees rising up out of the sea in Revelation is the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. Notice it has qualities of each one of the three before it. It was like a leopard, feet like the feet of a bear, mouth like the mouth of a lion. And it has 10 horns, the same as the fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7. Okay. So the same characteristics there. And what's interesting about this beast, the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority, is it operates the same way with the dragon as the Messiah does with God. So, you know, if you worship Jesus, you worship God, right? If you glorify Jesus, you glorify God. It's the same with the beast and the dragon. If you worship, follow after the beast, you're giving your worship to Satan. If you, serve the beast, you're serving Satan. It's by proxy. Satan gave the beast his throne and authority, just like God gave Christ his throne and authority. And in verse 3, it says, And I saw one of its heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? There's a lot of debate over what the death stroke was that had wounded one of its heads. I don't really think it's that important. I think the idea is that it was deception, right? In the form of, by a miracle, right, healing, and people were deceived by that and followed after it. That's the idea we get there from those two verses. It's the same kind of deception as 2 Corinthians. Chapter 11. In verse 13, such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. So there's deception here that gains the beast worship. In verse 5, he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. He was given authority to continue for 42 months, right? That's the time span of hardship of persecution. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. This also goes back to Daniel chapter 7, solidifying the connection between these two passages. Daniel chapter 7, start by looking at verse 8. I was considering the horns, so still on that fourth beast. There was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words, speaking great things, is another way of saying that. So we see the connection there. And then verse 11, I watched them because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Skip down to verse 17. And this is where it gets really interesting, the connection between these two chapters. Verse 17 says, those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. And the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn, which came up before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. And go look at Revelation 13, verse 7. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. It was definitely the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, and we can learn a lot about that through that passage. In verse 8 of Revelation 13, it reads, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Verse 9, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So there's a judgment against the beast here. All those on the earth whose names are not written in the book of life are following after the beast and worshiping the beast. But in verse 10, there's a judgment. The beast is going to be slain. And here is the patience and faith of the saints. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 22, then, he was making war and prevailing against the saints until the Ancients of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. In verse 11, there's a second beast that appears. It says, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, this time not the sea, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. There you could go again back to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. It's deception. Looks like a lamb, speaks with the authority of the dragon. So there's deception there as far as Christians go. Has a docile appearance and a deadly tongue. Verse 12, he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. Verse 13, he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And in verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So down through verse 15, we learn two really important things about the authority of the second beast, right? It's a proxy of the first beast. So if the first beast is Rome, right? The way that the dragon plans to persecute Christians in this historical context. First beast is Rome. The second beast has two horns, right, two situations of power. You can see it as the Roman political government and the Roman religious leadership, the emperor cult, right, emperor worship cult. They had, right, the power to take verse 15, for example, cause as many of those as who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. They had that power. They had the power to deceive by signs and lying wonders, like Paul would call them, in verse 14. And to force idolatry on people, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded, right? So we can kind of see how this beast would represent the facets of the first beast, the facets of the Roman persecution that was going on. Then in verse 16, it says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. We'll save verse 18 for a second. There's, you know, a lot that Hollywood has butchered for us from the book of Revelation. This is one of those spots. A lot of people think that you're actually going to be able to see the mark of the beast on people's hands or foreheads. That's not the case. This is talking about social political persecution, that those who did not succumb to worship the beast, those who did not fall to the idolatry, they were ostracized. They were not allowed to buy or sell. That's the idea here. Then in verse 18, it says, here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666, or 666. Again, Hollywood has butchered a lot of things about the book of Revelation. It's not the number of Satan, okay? It's not a number that gives Satan any power, nothing like that. It's symbolic.
What is funny, Isaac, it's not even really, it's associated with Satan for a roundabout way.
Yeah. Not even directly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, it's the number of the beast. It's the number of a man, not the number of some mystical force that Satan has in the movies, right? And that's not what we're talking about here. Because of verse 17, okay, there's a lot of debate about the number itself and what it represents. We know it's symbolic, but because of verse 17, there's a lot of people who try to apply a certain grammatical practice that the Hebrew, that was in the language of Hebrew, where they would sometimes use numbers in place of different things, often names. And so they want to translate the number 666 into an actual name. Some language experts have tried to do that. I don't really think that it bears anything. The names that they come up with don't really have a big significance at all. So I don't think that that's really the way to go. The way I think about it is, right, if seven is symbolic for divine completeness, then six would be symbolic of incompleteness, of failure, falling short. And so when things are grouped in threes, right, it's an emphasis being placed on it. Failure upon failure upon failure. I think that's the idea symbolized there by the number. All right. That concludes chapter 13. I know that was a lot of information. So we'll probably review some of those two chapters because next week is singing night. So starting in September, we'll go back and review this a little bit because it was a lot. But are there any comments or questions before we close out?
If one of them's literal and the other one, you have to be literal too, as far as
this. Yeah. Yeah, in chapter 7 and in chapter 14, both talks about the seal of God, them having the seal on themselves. but that's symbolic as well. It's just his claim on them.
It is interesting, these two chapters, as you've laid them out, you kind of step back, you really see a progression. The way Satan is conflicting with God's will and plan, trying to defeat the Son. He can't defeat the Son, so he tries to defeat, it almost seems like he tries to defeat the message and the establishment of the kingdom. That doesn't happen, and so he starts to persecute. And that doesn't happen, so now he's going through this roundabout way as his power is lessened through being overcome. Now he doesn't have this death hold over man anymore if they come to Christ, etc. But now he's trying to use this devious method. He's kind of using, and I think that may be the message that Revelation is trying to point out to his readers, that it's coming through different methods to try to, again, bring about still more deception and trying to bring them back.
It's another one of Satan's devices. We're not ignorant of his devices, like Paul says, right? I think that is the point. The main point is that this is Satan trying to get you to stumble. Endure.